good morning, Reading. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to my show Positively Healthy here on KCNR. Moving through October at quite a speed here. I want to give you a little update on some things happening around town. Well, at Orchard Nutrition next Saturday, they're having their Harvest Fest, and that's from 11 to 3. And you know what's fun about that is that out in front in their parking lot, you get to sample all sorts of cool foods that maybe you're interested in sampling when you're walking through their store, but it's a little bit uncool to open up the packages. But here at Harvest Fest, they actually serve you samples. And so next week we're having, October is Breast Cancer Prevention Month, and we're going to have a gal on talking about thermography. Her name is Michelle Hodge. She's a chiropractor. And, when we talk about cancer prevention, there is absolutely no room in my brain for repeated mammograms. So whenever you're doing something that actually causes cancer to see if you have cancer at some point, you know, when we talk about logic locks, that's one for me. So if we're going to talk about breast cancer prevention, we always have to look at the toxic chemicals that are cancer-causing that you're slathering all over your body in your personal care products and deodorant and makeup and nail polish, whatever, you know, hairspray, etc. And then we have to clean up the diet with all of those chemicals that are just endless. And so we also have a detection concept called thermography, which is really using heat detection. So when we look at breast cancer prevention, the first thing that happens when there's going to be cancer somewhere is that vascular changes happen. The body starts laying down more vessels, and so it works on getting a blood supply to the area. And so you can see that years before you have you're detected with cancer. So what's great about thermography is that for a very inexpensive price, you can change your diet, change your lifestyle before you actually have cancer. And that's called controlling your health and controlling your outcome, and we like that on this show. So I want to get on with I want to go to just another quick topic here before we go to our two unbelievable guests today. And I've promised you that in November, we're going to have some guests on to help us take this idea of, you know, I'm always trying to rework our economy, right? And so I'm trying to help us have cottage industry. I'm trying to help us, you know, you people out there with those ranchettes that have 3 and 4 and 7 acres, I just want you to grow things. I want you to have a crop that you grow. And we're going to use the example of creating an apple pie to sell at Orchard Nutrition. And so, because I love apple pie, and there's always a way to make it really natural and really healthy, and I like it fresh. And so, and I don't want it to be imported from some other town. I don't want it to come from another state. I want it to come from this county. And so we're going to take you through the process of, you know, who comes to look at your 2 apple trees to make sure that they aren't growing through your sewage line. So what kind of inspection does that take? What does it take to actually get a box and a barcode? And who's going to, you know, you have to make that in a commercial kitchen somewhere, because, you know, you can't make that at home. And so where are these commercial kitchens? What do they charge? How do we get this whole thing off the ground? And so, you know, I've promised you that we're starting with Fern Hastings from the county. She'll be here November 6th. And we're going to start talking through this whole process of what it takes for us to get local food produced. And so stay tuned, because we're going to figure out, we're going to have little, I almost want to say it like a kit, you know, like some handouts for you that you don't have to try to worm your way through this alone. And so, you know, according to some of our experts here, people just, they start out, they make a bunch of mistakes, they get depressed, they've spent way too much money, they hit a bunch of dead ends, and then they don't, you know, they just sort of give up, and it's easier to go on welfare or something. So what I'd like you to do is not to hit the wall right at the beginning. Let's help you through it. Let's figure out how to have success as a community, because I know we can. And the ultimate goal, of course, is for me to have a piece of fresh apple pie. So let's see here. We're going to take a quick radio break, and we'll be right back with our super guests right after this. Oh, welcome back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to my show Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. Remember, too, that you can always go on the computer at kcnr1460.com and listen that way. Or if you really like the show and you want to pass it on to your friends and family, they can listen to the podcast. Okay, so, you know, in the studio, we have Doug Bennett. Doug is a retired contractor and construction worker, and he lives in Reading. And he previously was an airborne Russian linguist in the Air Force Intelligence during the Vietnam War. And since retiring in 2000, he has become an advocate for democracy and justice. He is the founding member of the Shasta Tehama Trinity chapter of the ACLU Northern California, serving as their chapter representative since its inception. And he is the chairperson for Citizens for Responsible Government, and that is a local grassroots nonprofit. And he serves on the board of the Sustainable Earth Alliance. And, you know, he is just a dedicated community thinker. Would you call yourself that?
Yeah, hopefully.
Okay.
Hopefully I'm thinking.
Yeah. We're going to reward you for thinking. You're dedicated. Yeah. So welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And then we also, I want to make sure, now we have Alan on the line. Is Alan Hopper, are you with us? He's not with us?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So I want to start with Doug then. And so, Doug, let's start with, you know, part of, we were going to do a show on meth today. And so, you know, my concern is that, wow, you know, we've got some real health issues for people. This show is called Positively Healthy. It doesn't matter how much organic food you eat. You know, I mean, we lose great people to meth all the time. And some of that is because they didn't know how risky meth is. They didn't realize that sometimes just even the first time you use it, you're sort of gone, missing in action for the rest of your life. And so there's a certain amount of community. We have to do a little bit more educating there. We also have in the studio today Mark Beecham, who is sometimes a co-host. And so welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Trudy.
Yeah. And, you know, Mark's daughter was in town. She's 12. And we were talking to her a little bit about if she'd ever heard of meth. And her answer was no. But she had definitely heard of pot. And so we have moved, you know, What I've done with our meth show is I've moved it to after the election for people who were thinking we were talking meth today, and we're going to talk Prop 19. And so part of my interest in talking about Prop 19 is the fact that I'm trying to learn more about it. There was a time there when it looked like it wouldn't pass at all. Then it looked like in the polls it was kind of running pretty even. And right now we're just, you know, we've had a lot of interesting things happen with what the governor just did. And so, Doug, can you catch us up and start us off here in our program today? What the heck is this Prop 19, and what do we need to know about it?
Yeah, Prop 19 is not full legalization. It's partial legalization of marijuana for regular use, but what would be called recreational use. The initiative that's on the ballot would it would allow adults to possess, share, and grow small amounts of marijuana for their own use, less than an ounce. And it would still hold in place all the laws that protect minors, and actually would add some laws that would protect minors.
Okay. When we talk about protecting minors, just basically it's flat out illegal, or...
Well, basically because minors don't have very good judgment in general, just like we have laws that protect minors from alcohol and other substances, this new law would also put things in place that would protect them also, besides the ones that are already in place.
Okay. You know, because I want to include Alan right now, who has called in, and so we have an additional guest who's calling in today, and I just want to open it up to a round table of everybody and kind of catch him up with where we are. Okay, Alan, are you with us?
I am.
Hi, good morning. This is Alan Hopper, and he is the new police practices director of the ACLU of Northern California. And good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're in the process right now of, I just kind of did a little introduction to the fact that we're part of our show today. We're just going to hash through this Prop 19 and also go over what Governor Schwarzenegger has just his decisions, and you know, do we still need Prop 19? What are the pros? What are the cons? Are we safer in our county, Alan? We're having kind of a big crime wave, and you know, part of everybody is, I guess, but when you're a small, isolated community, you see it more because it's different than how it was, you know, 9 months ago or a year ago. And so some of our concerns really have to do with safety. They always have. They always will. Are we going to be safer with Prop 19? Are we more at risk? Is this encouraging something that has us feeling vulnerable? And so we have Doug Bennett here, and he was just starting to take us through the ins and outs of Prop 19. And so, Doug, go ahead and continue with that.
Yeah, I don't know if Alan heard what I said, but I basically just introduced it as the initiative that would allow adults to possess and share and cultivate small amounts of marijuana for recreational use. And I know Alan knows a lot more about the law than I do. You want to add something there, Alan?
Well, thanks, Doug. You know, there really are two components to the proposition, and the first is exactly as Doug has just described. It would eliminate statewide, as soon as it came into effect, it would eliminate criminal penalties, state law criminal penalties, for adults' possession, use, and cultivation of small amounts for personal use, while also leaving in place a host of laws that currently prohibit things like driving under the influence or any laws pertaining to drug use in the workplace, selling or giving away marijuana to minors. So really very limited in terms of its statewide effect, and just as Doug described. The second component of it, though, is a little bit more controversial, I think, and interesting, and it would allow but not require local governments, local city and county governments would be permitted to, if they wanted, establish their own local regulatory systems for that would allow and tax and regulate the sale of up to 1 ounce of marijuana per transaction from adults to adults. So, but the default statewide is that those laws don't change. The laws pertaining to sale or cultivation for sale of marijuana would remain in place unless and until a local government took the affirmative step of setting up its own local regulatory structure.
Okay, I'm a little confused about the regulatory structure. What, when you say, I mean, what would that look like for us in our town? In our county?
Sure. Yeah, and it depends. It might look like nothing at all, because your city and your county might decide that they want to leave sale of marijuana and cultivation for sale of marijuana completely illegal, in which case nothing would change on that front. But your city or county could choose instead to set up a licensing system that would permit some retail sales in a regulated manner in whatever way the city or county decided made most sense. So you could have, right now there are rules and regulations that vary some from city to city, county to county, pertaining to medical marijuana dispensaries, where they can open, how many of them can there be, what kind of restrictions are there on in terms of who the people can be that run them, and importantly, in this time of sort of economic stress at both the state and local levels, what kind of taxes and special fees and taxes will they have to pay to the city and local government. So you could have, anything from, one or two entities that would be permitted to sell marijuana over the counter up to an ounce at a time per transaction to adults. And the city might open up through some bidding process a request for proposals to allow people to submit proposals for being allowed to do that. and the city could limit it in really whatever way it wanted in terms of how, you know, the quantities, the total quantities that could be sold, the hours of operation, the location, you know, distance from, say, a school or other areas of town, limit it to only taking place in the more industrially zoned areas. So really any kind of regulatory and sort of time, place, manner restrictions that the local government chooses to put in place, that would be the rules for that particular locale.
Okay. Well, because this is radio, we need to take a radio break. Don't go anywhere. Stay on the line. You're listening to Positively Healthy, and we'll be right back.
My name is Barb.
Listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. We have Ellen Hopper from the ACLU, an attorney from the ACLU, Northern California, down in San Francisco, and we on the phone. And we have Doug Bennett from the ACLU, Northern California, in the studio. So welcome back, guests.
Thank you.
During the break, we realized that we're confused, and so or I'm confused. And so, Ellen, I wanna get clear. You know, we're kind of talking about whether or not you can have a dry county, so to speak, or whether or not we're tell us how we're self-regulating again.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good analogy, Trudy, to alcohol. I grew up in Texas, and I know that it is still the case there that while throughout the state, you know, alcohol is legal, that is, an adult can 21 years or older can possess alcohol anywhere in the state, but some counties do not allow the sale of alcohol over the counter, so that if you are an adult 21 years or older and you want to buy alcohol, you have to go to a county that permits the sale of alcohol. If you do that, you can buy it and drive back and have it in your own home, but you can't, there's no sale allowed in certain in counties in Texas, and that really is I think what you would see in California, that that throughout the state, possessions, personal possession for personal use of small amounts up to an ounce of marijuana would no longer be a crime for adults.
Okay. No.
And that would include limited cultivation. I believe that the initiative limits it to 25 square feet. So you imagine, you know, 5 by 5. Area, 5 feet by 5 feet, cultivation area for personal consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Can't sell it, can't give it away. But that would no longer be a crime anywhere. And then if a city or county chose to do so, they could allow retail sales.
Okay.
And then take the taxes from those sales and charge whatever kind of fees and taxes they wanted to on the local level.
And as retail sales could take many forms, I assume you could end up having like an Amsterdam coffee shop that would sell marijuana or marijuana products, correct?
You could. And again, that would be totally up to the local government. So a city might say, we're going to license a certain number of, exactly as you just said, cafes, where adults may go in, purchase, and consume on the premises small amounts of marijuana. A city might also say, though, no, we don't want any personal, we don't want any consumption going on except behind closed doors in the home, in private homes. So we're going to allow sale of small amounts of marijuana, but no place that sells it can allow consumption on the premises. That would be completely within the power of a city or county to decide for itself.
Hey, Ellen, how does this make us safer? How does this make us safer as a county, as a city, in our communities?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I think that the best analogy for thinking about the sort of relationship between drug use and crime is to think about the 20s during alcohol prohibition, when alcohol was illegal. You saw a burgeoning black market. Adults still had access to alcohol. There was just no regulated system by which it could be produced and they could obtain it. And so a black market rose up to meet that need. And that's what you see today with marijuana and with other drugs. And when you have a black market that's completely unregulated, I mean, one way of thinking about that is that only criminals are distributing, cultivating, and selling these substances. And so you have the crime that is associated with that kind of criminal, you know, with the activity that's not regulated by the government. You have turf wars. You have, you know, people who are often in, perhaps involved in other criminal activity beyond just the, you know, distribution or cultivation of marijuana. And the crime that you see associated with marijuana, to the extent that you do, is really a direct result of the fact that it is, there's a black market that's completely unregulated by the government. You don't see people shooting each other in the streets over alcohol today. You don't see turf wars over who's going to have control of a certain territory for selling alcohol. But you did see that during the 20s. I mean, that's Al Capone.
Are you in support of the legalization of all drugs?
Well, I am personally, or the ACLU. No, look, I think that over time, that the same rationale that I was just setting out probably applies to other drugs as well.
Uh-huh.
I think that it's a much different question, though,
okay,
when we talk about marijuana, because we know from the medical and scientific studies that have been done over years and years and years that alcohol, or rather that marijuana, is really about on par with alcohol in terms of health effects and the effect on the body. That marijuana really is probably safer in some ways than alcohol. I think that the addiction rates, for instance, with alcohol have been shown to be greater in terms of the number of people who, you know, the proportion of folks who use it, who become addicted to it. You know, the health costs associated with alcohol are much greater than they are with marijuana. So I think that it's an easy call right now today with marijuana. I think that it's a good way to test and see what happens. If Prop 19 passes, we will see over the next course of years whether crime does go down, whether use by young people does go down or go up,
and that
it is a low risk way to test this idea that the use of the criminal justice system to deal with public health issues that arise from drug problems, the use of the criminal justice system is an expensive and ineffective way to deal with it.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we have to take a radio break here, and we'll come back. We're going to ask Doug Bennett the same question here. So this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. We'll be right back.
Today.
Hello, welcome back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and in the studio we have Doug Bennett from the ACLU. We're talking Prop 19, and on the phone we have Alan Hopper, who is the new Police Practices Director of the ACLU in Northern California in San Francisco. And so welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so, Doug, I wanted to ask you kind of the same question, you know, about safety and Prop 19 and how you think when you ferret through it and you look at, you know, kind of picture it going into place, how is that going to help us?
Yeah, let me read you a little quote here just to start with, because I think it brings home part of the problem and what it kind of reinforces what Alan said. The quote is, "Alcohol and tobacco are far more dangerous drugs than cannabis, but no one is being killed in an alcohol or cigarette black market because those drugs are legal, regulated, and taxed." That's a quote from Joseph D. McNamara, retired chief of police for San Jose, California. And I can give you several other quotes. But what we do know is that their current drug war has been ineffectual for the money. We spent $2.5 trillion in the last 40 years. We have 60,000 arrests every year in California alone.
And that's just for marijuana.
And we have over from anywhere from 20 to 25% of the people in California prisons are there for drug-related crimes. And we as a country have kind of fallen down here as far as our how we handle these things. Most other industrialized countries handle these things as health problems. So they deal with it as an addiction, as a health problem when it becomes a problem. just like alcohol is not a problem for everybody, and marijuana wouldn't be a problem for everybody either, unless you're, you know, drinking and driving, DUI, and all those laws would still apply. So those safety things that provide more safety in the law are still there under this, but we would have a different way of dealing with, especially, you know, there's so many young people that end up in jail, and then you have a recidivism problem once people go to jail for minor drug. Sometimes that escalates into worse crimes in the future. And when they're labeled, you know, it's harder to get a job. After they go to prison, they come out with a prison record. They're on probation. It's a big problem as far as our incarceration systems that we have in place in the United States. We have the largest incarcerated population in the United States than any other industrialized country in the world. And we have the biggest drug problem also.
Mark?
Yeah. In California, we obviously have medical marijuana cooperatives in many, many cities. And the governor in the last week or 10 days signed a law that essentially made possession of less than an ounce an infraction, I think punishable by a maximum of $100. Isn't marijuana essentially legal for all intents and purposes in California under current law? And what do we gain by going to Prop 19?
That sounds like a good one for Alan.
thanks, Mark. And I have been thinking about this, and of course saw the governor's, you know, having signed the decrim bill. And just to be clear, for quite some time now, the maximum penalty in California for personal possession of up to an ounce of marijuana has been a $100 fine. But it remained a misdemeanor, so that if you were charged with possession of a small amount of marijuana, you had the right to a court-appointed lawyer and all of the due process rights that are afforded to any criminal defendant. You also had all of the collateral consequences of a conviction follow you around for the rest of your life if you were convicted. So what this decrim bill that the governor has signed, which has been presented, the legislature has tried to do this in the past and it's been vetoed. It's been an idea that's been around for a while, and I think that part of Governor Schwarzenegger's motivation in signing that bill now was exactly to try to help this argument that hey, we don't need Prop 19 because we now have decriminalization. But it's not the same thing. Right now we know that the marijuana laws in California, as in the rest of the country, are enforced in an incredibly racially discriminatory way. There were studies done in New York and then in California over the past year or so that showed that a young black man is something like three times as likely as his white counterpart to be arrested for a minor marijuana offense in the urban areas, San Francisco, Los Angeles, in California. That's not going to change with this decrim bill. The police are still going to be doing the same sorts of racial profiling that they have been doing, and instead of it being a misdemeanor, it's now going to be an infraction, but it's still going to be falling disparately on the black and brown shoulders of our citizens.
Hey, Alan, I want to get in here with a caller real fast, okay? So I want to go to line two here. We have Alana. Alana?
Hi, Trudy.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to call in and ask Alan and Doug a couple of questions.
Sure.
I've been listening to the show, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate here because the flavor of what I'm hearing is that this is not a big deal. It's no big deal to legalize marijuana. It probably should have been done before. And if you leave medical marijuana out of it, which is, to me, a completely different issue, I had a couple of questions. And one is that even if this is legal in California, it's still going to be illegal federally to, you know, to have possession of marijuana, to smoke or grow marijuana. So if we have federal agents in California, they can actually still arrest, you know, marijuana users anytime they come through the state. How do you reconcile the fact that if we make it legal in California, it's still federally against the law, much like in Arizona, for example, they tried to, you know, write their own border law, enforce their own border law, and now our own president is suing them saying you can't. It's against federal law what you're doing. So how do we reconcile that?
Doug, you want to take that or?
Well, I think Alan's better prepared because he knows personally what that interface is between the federal law and the state laws, and that's an excellent question. Alan can probably handle that better.
Yeah, it is an excellent question. Thanks for calling in, Alana. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is that, yes, federal law will remain in place, much as it has been the situation with medical marijuana. So federal law enforcement could theoretically still continue to enforce federal law. But there are a couple of important points to keep in mind. One is that the situation with drug law enforcement is much different than immigration law. And I've seen this comparison drawn in the media recently between the Arizona situation and Proposition 19, and it really just doesn't fit. And here's why. The way that those laws are written, the federal government has occupied the field of immigration law enforcement, which makes sense. It's an international issue. The federal government is in charge of making sure that the borders are safe, and the federal government is in charge of developing immigration policy. So it is explicit in the statutory structure of those laws that the states really can't enact their own immigration laws because it doesn't make sense to have a patchwork of immigration laws around the border. When it comes to drug law enforcement, though, Congress did something much different. When they enacted the Controlled Substances Act, the federal law, the federal drug laws, they said, we do not intend to occupy the field of drug law enforcement. In fact, we encourage the states to develop their own criminal law and regulatory structures dealing with drugs. And as a practical matter, that makes sense because the federal government just doesn't have the resources to enforce all of the drug laws all across the country. Of all the arrests for illegal drugs in the country, 99% of them take place at the state and local level by state and local law enforcement.
Well, I mean,
a very small
percentage
are enforced by the federal government. So,
in 2008, there was actually about 847,000 marijuana-related arrests in the country, and about 6,000 of them were performed by federal agents. My question is, say, you know, you're a California resident and you're comfortable, you know, carrying around your 1 ounce at a time and growing your pot plants in the backyard, and you realize that as an adult, you know, you're allowed to do this. So you see a highway patrol person and you don't worry about it. But then you see a federal agent, then what do you do? Because the truth is you're not exactly legal. You're only legal within the borders of California, provided that a federal agent doesn't find you.
That's exactly right. And that leads to certainly, as a practical matter, the risk of being arrested by a federal law enforcement agent for possession of a very small amount of marijuana is very low, but it certainly remains the case that the federal government can enforce its own laws. But what will be the reaction of the Obama administration if Proposition 19 passes? We've seen the Obama administration's policies with regard to medical marijuana have been much different than preceding administrations. And the federal government has said, in effect, although there are always exceptions, but generally speaking, that if medical marijuana patients and providers are complying with local and state laws, the federal government will not make it a priority to go after them. Now, we don't know what the federal government will choose to do if they would take a similar tack with Prop 19 and with non-medical marijuana use. But as a practical matter, they're not going to be able to just flood the state with DEA agents and enforce, you know, these very small and minor marijuana offenses. And I think that there is, from a philosophical perspective, there is a time-honored tradition of allowing the states to be laboratories for innovative social policies. That's something the Supreme Court has recognized that's built into our federalist system of government with separate state and federal sovereigns. And so I think that you may well see the federal government decide, let's just take a hands-off approach and see what happens in California.
Hey, okay. Alan, we need to take a radio break here. And so, Alana, you want to hang on over the break, or
I don't want to monopolize your show. I did have a couple other questions, but I know you guys probably have some things you want to talk about. So
okay.
I'll let you go. But thank you, Alan and Doug and Trudy, for addressing this issue. And,
sure.
You guys have a great day.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy, and we'll be right back.
My name is Barbara Harrison. I've worked with
Hello, welcome back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. Remember, you can hear this again on the podcast if you want. You can hear it over and over and over on KCNR1460.com. And I want to welcome Alan Hopper back. Alan, are you with us still?
I am, Trudy.
Oh, good. And I want to welcome Doug back, Doug Bennett here. He is from Reading. I wanted to have you clarify a little bit the state law versus federal law enforcement a little bit for us.
Sure, Trudy, thank you. And that was such a great question from your caller, because it is something that, you know, is apparently kind of contradictory. But I think it's important just to recognize where we are today with medical marijuana and medical marijuana dispensaries across the state. Just as would be the case with Prop 19 if it were to pass, federal law continues to prohibit all medical marijuana use. So all of the medical marijuana cooperatives that are operating in communities across the state are doing so in violation of federal law. There's no debate about that. And yet the federal government really is leaving them alone. You don't see, these businesses are being allowed to operate in our communities more and more like a regular business would operate. They're paying sales taxes. They are, you know, extending benefits to their workers. They're productive members of the community. And so,
okay.
I think that there is a real possibility, and we would hope for the best, that the federal government may take the same approach were Prop 19 to pass tomorrow, because they just don't have the ability to go in and start arresting every single person who's engaging in this activity if the state laws have changed.
Okay. Hey, I want to go to a caller. We have Dennis on line one. Dennis, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for calling. Do you have a question for our guests?
Well, I just wanted to address the lady that called in earlier,
mm-hmm,
around the federal government separation. And I personally think that originally the United States was set up as a republic, and I don't see any constitutional basis for the federal government or the courts saying that the marijuana was illegal. And I think passing Proposition 19 could set the stage, so to speak, to be a groundswell to start moving and change that law. I think it's important to keep the independence of the states as a republic, and so forth.
Alan, you want to address that?
And thanks so much for the question and comment. And I agree with you that you know, there are, look, we live in a federalist system of government. There are certain areas of legislative and public policy authority that have been delegated to the states. And as I said earlier, I mean, there is a time-honored tradition of the states acting as sort of laboratories for new, novel, innovative social policies and experiments. And I think that marijuana, the relaxing of the laws around marijuana, first medical marijuana, and now perhaps broader legalization on a state level, are perfectly suited for that kind of local state experimentation without threat to the rest of the nation to see if these policies might actually be smarter, be more economically effective, and might just lead to a better society.
Mark, do you have a question?
Yeah, slightly changing the subject here. Alan, we have a prison overcrowding situation in California. The governor is beginning to furlough prisoners, dumping them on local counties. Our county is one of them. We have courtrooms that are jammed. It takes way too long to get through our courts. If Prop 19 were to pass, what benefit would that have on both prisons and our judicial system?
That's a very good question, Mark, and I don't have at my fingertips the exact sort of facts and figures, but I can tell you the ACLU has looked at this carefully, and we have been for a while. And we know that, exactly as you just point out, the state and the country beyond really have a serious over-incarceration problem right now. We're incarcerating far larger proportion of our population than any civilized society really ever has. I mean, we imprison more folks now. There are more young black men in prison now than under the Jim Crow, pre-Jim Crow, the pre-Civil War days in our prisons and jails across the country. So, any laws that move away from and new policies that move away from this overuse of the criminal justice system to deal with issues of public health and public policy are going to have a beneficial effect in terms of being able to focus the criminal justice resources in the places where it's needed most. So, the police and the courts and our jails and prisons ought to be dealing with violent people who are hurting other people. Those should not be the sort of mechanism of first resort for dealing with issues of public health or morality or public policy issues that don't involve that kind of violent crime.
I have one other sort of unrelated question, but I've heard many people make this equivalency argument between marijuana and alcohol. There's really no difference, et cetera. But in my own mind, in my own experience, limited though it may be, marijuana today, I know, is a lot different than marijuana was back in, say, 1968, much stronger, much more potent. And fundamentally, people consume marijuana for a different reason than they would sit down and have a social glass of wine or a social glass of beer. They consume marijuana to get stoned, to get intoxicated to a point where maybe it wouldn't be safe behind a wheel or operating machinery or something like that, whereas a lot of people consume alcohol for not that purpose. How do you address that argument that marijuana is not quite the same thing as alcohol?
Yeah, maybe I can take that. There's a great book which I recommend to everybody, Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence by Mitch Earlywine. It's scientifically based. And at the end of the chapter entitled Marijuana Health Effects, it says, occasional use by healthy adults does not appear to create dramatic mental or physical illness. Cannabis seems to have fewer negative health effects than legal drugs like alcohol, caffeine, or tobacco, and kills far fewer people. So I think when we talk to the issue of usage, it falls on individuals to be responsible in their usage, as it always does, and if they break some other law, they're still liable under those other laws, whether it be property damage or some criminal aspect that's not related to the drug use necessarily. I know we only have a couple more minutes left.
We've got 1 minute left. What I'd like to do is, Alan, have you just give us really fast here the nuts and bolts of Prop 19. I mean, I know it's still illegal for kids. I know you can have an ounce on you. What else?
Yep, still illegal for kids or to use it in front of kids, still illegal to drive while intoxicated, no impact on an employer's ability to make sure that people aren't using drugs in the workplace or causing dangerous situations in the workplace, and no commercial sales allowed unless and until a local government allows that to happen. And when local governments do allow that to happen, what you will see is an elimination, a reduction first, and then an elimination of the black market and the crime and violence that are associated with it.
Alan, what does it look like in the polls right now for Prop 19?
You know, the latest poll that I saw was from PPIC, which I understand to be sort of on par with field polls in the state in terms of their accuracy, and it showed Prop 19 up by over 10 or 11 points. I think it was 53 to 42% in favor, with 7 or 8% still undecided. I think that the polls are looking stronger and stronger in support of Prop 19 as we get into this final stretch, and it's looking more and more like it really is going to become law.
Okay. Well, the views of this show are always to inform people so they can decide for themselves what's the most interesting and important to them. And, Alan, I want to thank you for coming on, and same with you, Doug. Gosh, I love information. It helps empower everyone. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. See you next week.